in every system, there are flaws in the way that the system moves and the way that the system works. And like any book that attempts to write about a specific system will highlight the flaws, but it doesn't mean that a flawed system is peculiar to just the space in which the writer is writing.
Welcome to the first and only podcast dedicated to the Nigerian law school experience and life after, the Fit and Proper Podcast. And I'm your host, Jewel Owolano. How you all doing? Thank you for joining in on another episode of the podcast. Today is a different experience, like a mad one. We are having a crossover episode with the Fit and Proper podcast, which is also produced by DigiLaw. And it is returning for the second season. And it's going to be hosted by a very lovely lady, bar aspirant, Jewel Owolano. And how are you doing today, Jewel?
Hi, Ufoma. It's great to be here. Good evening.
Good evening. So the Fit and Proper podcast is a podcast that focuses on the curriculum of the Nigerian Law School and particularly aimed at the audience of the NLS, that's the Nigerian Law School. And the podcast also discusses the experiences of lawyers, law students in Nigeria, and just generally everything surrounding the journey to the bar. Season one was hosted by Fabulous Keyukemi Ubi, and I had the honor of hosting on some sessions of property law. So I'm excited that we're really having this crossover duo, and I can't wait for, you know, the bar aspirants to listen to you hosting season two of the podcast. So I know our listeners at home will be wondering, what was this crossover episode? Which one is law coming into writer's source? You know, I thought we were here for literature, but if you've been following the podcast, you'll be aware that I am a lawyer and my co-host Faith is a law student as well. And we love any opportunity to speak with lawyers in the arts, although Faith is not on the episode today. But myself and Jewel will be speaking with an amazing lawyer who is also a fabulous writer today. Our title this episode is Where Law Meets Literature. So guys at home, join us as we welcome Olaoluwa Omi, the author of the novel The YNBA. Welcome, Olaoluwa.
Yay.
Welcome. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, Joel. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the introduction. It's both flattering and producing. When you say fabulous writer and lawyer, I'm like, oh, that's a nice compliment, but let's see if I can live up to it.
You're welcome. So guys, like you said, Olaoluwa is a writer and lawyer practicing in Nigeria and in New York. Over to you, Jewel.
Wow, welcome, Olaoluwa. It's so great to have you here. I mean, when our producer at DigiLaw brought up the idea about this course, I was so excited. I mean, like, to have you come join us on our podcast. And today we'll be, you know, discussing about your debut novel, The YNBA, which basically means the Young NBA, as in the Nigerian Bar Association. So we're excited to have you here. So the YNBA is an expose to the realities of the experiences of young lawyers in Lagos and then generally Nigeria, and it tells of the oppression that pervades the legal profession and really captures like all too familiar conflicts between the old and the new. I mean, we all know this. If you're in the law space, you know this. And well, let me just go into the blurb to give our listeners an insight to the book. And this will lay a foundation for our discussion today. So I'll go on to read. Otunba Yemi Carrington, a senior advocate of Nigeria, goes to work on Saturday and realizes that all 28 employees in his top litigation firm have resigned. As he figures out to keep his firm afloat, he uncovers a secret organization of young lawyers, the eponymous YNBA, formed as a counter group to the NBA. Wow. Okay, so we're focusing on the legal aspects of the book, and we leave you, you know, our audience to, you know, grab a copy and enjoy the story to fullest, because, you know, what I read is just the tip of the iceberg. You have to get the book. Okay, so over to you, Ufoma.
Really, they really need to get the book, because there's, other than the fact that it's about some bunch of lawyers, there are like some things that are really gone in the book. There's a love triangle, there's this and this, but you know, we're not going to give you the story. Go and read for yourself.
Just like creeping here. I know, like, you guys are like doing your own thing, but I'm just creeping here to ask, like, every time anybody talks to the book, well, when I was writing the book, I was just like, it's going to be a legal drama, but it's also going to be about people. So there are some aspects of human relationships that we can't
avoid. Yeah.
And I feel like everybody who has talked with me about the book always want to emphasize the human relationship part. And I'm just like, I don't want to talk about, let's talk about the law.
Well, it's important now. It's also juicy. But yeah, so you guys have heard it too. You're like, see, just get yourself a copy of the YNBA by Olaoluwa Oni and give yourself a treat. So thank you, Joel, for giving us the blurb of the book and just main foundation for today, what we're going to be talking about. So I think we've already said that this book is really interesting to read, and I, for one, must commend how Nigerian the book is. Like, it's really Nigerian. I particularly liked how names were properly accentuated, and how Pidgin was not italicized, how Yoruba was not interpreted. Like, it's just there in the pure language. So, you know, you actually picked up a Nigerian book and you're reading a Nigerian book. The nice blend of English, Pidgin, Yoruba, it just made everything like, the writer knew what she was doing. So, Olaoluwa, you are a practicing lawyer, both in Nigeria and in New York, as we already said. I would like to know, how exactly were you able to, like, put this book together? Can you share your experience of both worlds, working in New York and working in Nigeria as a lawyer, and how it influenced you writing this book?
Sure.
How did law come to meet the picture for you?
Of course, definitely. I should first of all start off by prefacing to say that, yes, I practiced in Nigeria, then I practiced in New York. But as of August 2021, I started my graduate PhD degree program. And so, I mean, I'm sort of not like actively practicing in New York now. But I mean, let's see where the future takes us within the next, I don't know, few years. But definitely, there's a long background to this, in the sense that one of the things that particularly drew me to law, and I mean, this is commentary I've made in many instances where I've been asked, is that I've always felt like I studied law not because I wanted to be a lawyer, but because I had to study. Like, so I was a lawyer, and that's why I studied law. I've always imagined myself to be a lawyer. I haven't, like, sort of seriously considered myself as being anything but a lawyer. Some of it is because I'm a Nigerian kid, and like, your parents sort of assign from birth what the child will be. They're like, this one will be a doctor, this one will be a lawyer, this one will be an architect. And like, somehow it's assigned for their children panned out. And so I've always grown up with the notion that I was going to be a lawyer. I've always enjoyed the prospect of entering into the legal profession. And I realized that I had a very set idea of what being a lawyer was going to look like. It was going to look like the courtroom cases and the drama, and like standing in front of a juror and shouting, "Objection, my lord!" And then there would be like intense suspense music playing in the background. And in tandem with this, when I was studying law at the University of Lagos, I was a member of the Moot Society, which, I mean, both of you are lawyers, so you will sort of understand the concept of mooting. But for audience members who are not lawyers, is somewhat like simulating a courtroom experience. And so the participants would have a set of facts and they would argue it before a panel of judges. And the whole idea is to sort of train you in the art of oral advocacy. And so I like actively participated in that. I was like, I felt fully ready to like join the legal profession and like astound the world with my oratory skills. I had watched Ali McBeal and Law and Order and Boston Legal. And I was like, just watch out for me, world. And then I started practicing law in Nigeria. And I realized that absolutely nothing about the system of legal education, about what we consume in terms of legal entertainment, prepares the Nigerian lawyer for the reality of law practice in Nigeria. I mean, there is, first of all, the idea of like all advocacy, especially as a junior lawyer, is like I'm side-eyeing it because the judge is like, please adopt your brief and sit down. Like you make and break your argument on the strength of like the written argument, and you don't get an opportunity to actually explore oral advocacy. And so from when I started practicing law, I started making like little anecdotes here and there about what I found interesting and peculiar about law practice in Nigeria. And like these were the, I didn't know it at the time, but these were the foundations for what eventually became the YNBA, which the book attempts to capture what it's like as a young lawyer in Nigeria. And so, I mean, the anecdote started from what I observed, but then sort of expanded into what my colleagues at the time, what friends at the time were talking about, their own experiences as well, which is like remarkably different from what we could have ever anticipated going into law practice. And so like that's how I think the YNBA was sort of birthed from my actual practice of law in Nigeria. But then you also asked about practice of law, like comparing practice of law in Nigeria to practice of law in New York, which I think again is like markedly different, because that thrill of oral advocacy that I really wanted, I got in New York. So the New York system, at least of civil litigation, which is the field I practiced in, very happily embraces like oral advocacy. You get your chance to, you know, make your oral arguments, and you get your chance to be like, oh, I need to, because I'm trying to like make this point, I'm going to like dress in this way so that the moment I like stand up, I'm already communicating something with my body language and my dressing and everything. And it's just a lot more, like if you tend towards the dramatics, you would really enjoy law practice in New York. If you are more of an introspective, I just want like calm and jeje and let's just make the argument, and let's make it purely about the argument, you might be more inclined to law practice in Lagos. But all in all, I mean, nothing about my practice of law in New York made it into the book per se, because by the time I was admitted to study, I was admitted to practice as an attorney in New York, the book was already like sort of fully formed. But a lot of my experience practicing as an attorney in Lagos informed a lot of the book.
Oh, well. Thank you.
Jinx.
Yeah. Wow, that was really profound, Olalua. And, you know, just going by what Jude Jijon said, he was like, the humor and the depth that the YNBA challenges the legal profession to put first what truly matters, our collective humanity, love and sound judgments. And it's actually great that you sort of now have drawn the distinction between, you know, practice in Nigeria and practice in New York. But now, speaking on your experience here, you know, your legal profession here in Lagos, can you just, you know, talk about what we find here in Nigeria, you know, with the way associates are treated, young associates, how they struggle to climb the ladder, you know, where, you know, they have to be subservient to a so-called partner. And we see the thing here in the book. So can you just speak to what sort of hardships young lawyers face in the legal profession?
Yes, for sure, Joel. I want to also sort of preface my answering this question by saying that I don't even think that it's peculiar to law, like this idea of the establishment communicating its authority by oppressing like the new people coming in. I don't think it's peculiar to the legal profession. I think it cuts across like employment relationships in Nigeria, across different industries. But to speak specifically to law, which is what I'm most familiar with, I want to start off by saying, and I think I should do justice to sort of the people that a lot of people who directly supervised me when I was entering into the profession. So I want to start off by saying that I was fortunate enough to be supervised by mostly, you know, just really remarkable and really great people who understood what tendering and mentorship meant in terms of grooming young lawyers to become like better and well-adjusted members of the profession. But that being said, I think that those people who were like kind and who understood the assignment, as it were exceptions to the rule. And some experience, a lot of observation and a lot of listening, it seems as though it's just an all-round sort of pulsating, pervasive environment of oppression. It starts from little things like you join a law firm thinking that you're coming to practice law, and then you're not even given like simple tasks like, oh, go and do the research. You're given tasks like sweep the office or go and buy food, all the way through to when it gets into the courtroom, and then, you know, an older lawyer comes and is like, get up from the seat and let me sit down because I am the older lawyer. And I think it's also systemic in the sense that it's not even a system that is anchored on sort of the idiosyncrasies of each individual older lawyer. I think it's embedded into the system, this idea that not only should we respect the older lawyers, we should expect that they will oppress us and we should cave under that oppression and sort of just prepare ourselves for when we become older lawyers, maybe we'll have our own opportunity to do so. It's hard to begin to, and I find that with systems that are so entrenched, it's hard to begin to be like, oh, and then there was this one instance of, and then there was this one instance of, but I'm going to try. And like, this one is fresh in my mind because it happened like 3 months, no, what am I saying? Like 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago, I was in a Nigerian courtroom, and it was a magistrate courtroom, which I found like especially interesting. I guess the magistrate was upset with a lawyer for the way the lawyer was conducting their case. And just even the language, the derision, the mockery that the magistrate was throwing at the lawyer, I was truly like concerned. And I was commenting on it to somebody who had been in the courtroom longer, and he was like, oh, this is a small issue. Just a few hours earlier, this same magistrate to a different lawyer had like come down from her bench to physically push the lawyer out of the courtroom because she was upset with the lawyer.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And that's, I was like, yeah, so, you know, if I wrote this as something that happened in the book, people would be like, this is an exaggeration. How can this happen? Profession in Nigeria. Reality and real life facts is much more bizarre than anything we could ever think about in fiction. And so like that's on the angle of like judicial oppression of lawyers. But then, so there's an aspect in my book, if you guys pick it up, and it happens pretty early on, so it's not a spoiler, where an older lawyer turns to a younger lawyer in open court and starts to insult him, like, oh, open mm-hmm. is like essentially mm-hmm. a person. That aspect is directly derived from a real true experience. I wasn't a younger lawyer teacher, but it happened. And one of the things I find really startling is most people who have read the book and who are sort of familiar with law practice in Lagos especially, are always like, yeah, I know who this person is. I know. And they almost always guess right. And I'm like, that's the evidence of how sad things are. That I can write this truly horrific picture. I can paint this truly horrific picture. And people can not only directly relate to it, but can actively guess correctly and name an older lawyer who behaves like this.
Mm.
That's the telltale of how decrepit the whole system is.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, so comparing your experiences with that of Nigeria and then in New York, do we find this systemic oppression elsewhere? I mean, is this just a Nigerian experience, or do we find this happening in other clients and other jurisdictions?
Yes. I should just like this simple answer is yes, it is everywhere. But sort of like the more nuanced answer is, one of the things I worried about when I was writing the YNP was that I didn't want people to read it, especially like the people for. So I'm going to do that very unwritely thing and admit that I had a very specific audience that I was writing to, and I knew exactly who I wanted to have my book, and like they played in my head when I was writing the book. And one of the things I was worried about is that with a book, once it's out in the world, you can't regulate who reads it and who has access to it. And I was worried that people who are not part of the core audience I had in mind would take the book and sort of just run off with the idea that, oh my gosh, these barbaric Nigerian legal practitioners that are just like on a cruise on their own, doing their own mad thing. Oh, thank God we're not like them. But in actuality, at least in the two jurisdictions where I practice law, they both have their own problems with how they handle new entrants to the bar and people who like on the fringe identity. So for example, in New York, I was both a Black person and a female attorney who was practicing in litigation. And so because litigation especially is heavily anchored on perception, so how the judge perceives you, how your opponent perceives you, how the jurors perceive you, in many ways speaks to how you will be treated, how your arguments will be received. The social issues of like racism and sexism inevitably plays in. And so in New York, I found myself sort of fully conscious of how Black I was in a way that I didn't find myself conscious of that in Nigeria. So in Nigeria, the issue is like if somebody's acting funny to me in the courtroom, I would also think, oh, it's probably because I'm a woman and he's not used to women being, I don't know, litigators. But in New York, there was also the added complexity of because I'm Black. And so what I essentially came to realize is that in every system, there are flaws in the way that the system moves and the way that the system works. And like any book that attempts to write about a specific system will highlight the flaws, but it doesn't mean that a flawed system is peculiar to just the space in which the writer is writing. Like I said, the short answer is yes. You know, there is a system of oppression that pervades any society, anywhere, you know, human beings gather. It's just like different things are used to signal or different things are used to feed what would influence who we oppress or why we oppress. I feel like that was a very complicated answer. I hope the point was made.
It was definitely.
It was made. Okay, so yeah, so I think if we didn't talk about like your experience in New York Bar, I would have thought that this was really a Nigerian thing. And I still think that it's really bad in Nigeria anyways, because reading through the book, I'm just going to point out, you already spoke about the part that the senior lawyer called the junior lawyer, was calling you names. There was also a part that the senior lawyer asked a junior lawyer to strip himself of his robes and go out. And then the main character, Otumba, pays his associates little to nothing. And we keep on seeing these issues every day. And people write about it. Law students write about it. Talk about internships where either, they don't get the opportunity to actually learn at internships, or when they go to places they can actually learn, they're not getting paid. That's even for internships. Not to talk about you actually becoming an associate and then going into the practice and you're going to court and you're being treated here and there. I would never understand why we can't have the old accept the new coming and then help them grow. So talking about that, let's think. I think we're still on the same line. But this particular battle, this constant battle that the old and the new has, which the book speaks to, is really something that I'm trying to understand. Why is it there? Because there is Otumba parenting for the older generation of lawyers who is, oh, we are the best things in sliced bread. I'm a fan. I can do what I want. I walk into court like I own the place. And then there's Jiboye and the other lawyers who are part of the YMBA representing the, you know, the younger generation. And there was something Spring NG said in their review of the book that also speaks to this. And I would just read out briefly. I noted it down. And it was something like, the YMBA versus the MBA crisis that persists through the novel is an unpleasant reflection of the perception and reality of the profession's moral state. Shame that it should be the profession that should uphold fairness and equity. So talking about fairness and equity, I think this is supposed to be the place where, you know, all are welcome. I spent 5 years in uni. I spent 1 year in Nigerian law school. after all that sweat, I get to wear the wig and gown, which Stage Whisper I don't really like wearing. And then I come out to this profession and I'm being treated like I'm nothing. Why exactly? So I think what I'm trying to ask is, why is there this constant power thirsting? Can you tell why? Is it that the older generation feels threatened by the younger generation of lawyers, or what do you think causes this constant power thirsting?
Yeah, like that's a very hard question to answer, because it that we can like logically speak to human
conduct.
Like a lot of human behavior is largely illogical and mostly emotional. But I also wanted to say that you're absolutely right when you talk about how having spent like 5 years, or in fact 6 years if we're being honest, because you do law school as well, studying law, and having been sort of saturated with how things should happen, you're released into a system that defies everything you know about how things should work, and you're expected to just take it and accept it. And that's what I find to be one of the most insidious aspects of how the system is organized. I remember I was on Twitter the other day, and somebody was like, it's so funny that a lot of lawyers are working without an employment contract, but these lawyers will be expected to defend clients of the firm who are working without employment contracts. So like you as a partner in a law firm who's running a practice with the worst labor law violations will take it, who is alleging a labor law violation, and give it to your junior associate who is experiencing a labor law violation, and tell him, go and defend this person because he's really badly. And you don't see the irony in it. And so like, that's what I find in CBOs. Like, you have to think so little of the junior associates that you have, or the lawyers that you have, that you think that you can expect them to know the extent of the abuse you're meting out on them, but that they will not do anything about it. Like it's almost like a cognitive dissonance that I want to sit down with an older abusive lawyer and be like, tell me how this works out in your mind. And you'll be like, you know, you go and defend this client of mine because his boss is violating his rights, but you must not tell me I'm violating your rights, even though I know that you know that I'm violating your rights. Like, how does that work out? And so like you said, how does this happen? I don't know. The only thing that I can say that I guess nuances it is that I don't think they know any better. I think that a lot of people like worked under, and I think I tried to capture this in the book as well, like worked under systems that were just as the ones that they are perpetuating. I remember an older lawyer telling me that, oh, in his days when he was studying law, when he was under tutelage, it's like the expression they love to use, when he was under pupillage, they were expected to use their own like non-existent salaries to buy the books that would be in the law firm's library. And so like find the money wherever it is you want to find it. And then, you know, you are responsible for keeping the law library not only stocked with books, but stocked with updated books. And we will not be paying you a salary. I don't know where you expect us to. I don't know where we expect you to get the money, but that's fine. But I'm like, so I guess, I mean, if these people are coming from a system like that, surely they feel so generous when like they pay their own young lawyers pittances, because they're like, well, at least we are paying you money and we're not asking you to keep the law library stocked. So that's some sort of progress. I'm like, yeah, maybe like that's what they like look to as justification. Like they sort of like don't understand how truly ridiculous and insidious their behavior is. But it's also that these people, I think, you know, I mean, a lot of them at least have children who are lawyers themselves. And I'm like, if your child told you that their boss was doing to them what you do to your young attorneys, how would you feel? And so if you can try to protect your child from, you know, activities that mirror what you are doing, then surely you know what you're doing is wrong. And it's hard, like I said, it's human behavior. We're not known to be the most logical or the most reasonable people on the surface of the earth. So what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Wow. And it's funny because we're in 2021 and you can't guarantee psychological safety in some law firms. I mean, it's sad. And the oppression isn't just targeted to lawyers. I mean, even law students. So I haven't been to law school, so I'm not a lawyer yet, but I'm a law graduate. And I've been on internships. And, you know, it's funny how in 2020 or 2021, there's some law firms that do not pay their interns. And it's so funny because, I mean, like, you come to work every day, you spend transport money, you do the work. The work you do sometimes will even involve you doing menial chores. You're not supposed to do that, right? Like, how can you justify this? Like, what's your take on this? Like, why would you treat, because these law students would definitely become lawyers, and with the same eyes, you're looking at them with the same eyes, oh, these were once interns, especially if you're retained in the firm where you did your internship. So what do you think is the problem exactly? Are the older lawyers, you know, are they oblivious? Like, can they empathize or put themselves in the shoes of young people and just kind of think and see, oh, this is not right, and this can continue? Especially when you speak out and point this out to them. Can you just speak to that, please?
Oh, no. I mean, I hope that I am myself not like, I hope like nobody has like experienced me as somebody who, you know, oppressed them. And so, because I hope that, I'm like, I don't think I can speak to what goes on in the mind of an oppressor. But I also think that there's something deeply cultural, like not in terms of legal culture, but in terms of social culture, about the expectations that we put on people who are younger than us. And so it's this idea that your employee is not just providing a very specific tailored service for income in terms of their salary, they are your child for you to like do as you will with them and for you to further the process of their upbringing. Because like that's the only thing I can think about why you, I mean, and I know there have been instances where people would ask like an intern to sweep the office or like go and buy food or clean the toilet. Surely, if we were analyzing like the pure terms of labor relations, contract of employment, you know you're out of bounds. But I think there's a cultural expectation that you, like, what is a contract of employment anyways? Are we not all one big family? Can't I send you? Am I not old enough to be your parent and send you to go and do something? Now. And I think some of that sentiment is what is feeding into how young lawyers are treated, young potential lawyers and lawyers are treated. And if we're going to uproot the system, it's not just about insisting on a reworking of the legal profession. It's about insisting on a mental shift on how we treat people who we perceive are younger than or not as achieved, or who haven't achieved as much as we have. You know, it's that people are people. Of dignity, and like let us have that be the foundation with which we approach things.
Well, yes, I think so, and I think they should start with thinking paying interns, because I feel like unpaid internships for law students is still 2018.
Yeah, for sure. Not even, I think it's not even 2018. I think that I already thought it was unjust.
Right.
And I think that was like what 2013. To be fair though, I was paid. Like, let me not malign the people that I interned with. I was paid.
I was paid too. but I had friends who worked in top law firms that were not paid. And it's almost like, oh, we are training you, you're learning. Yeah, I'm learning, but I'm also doing the work. Like, associates give me actual work to do. Mm-hmm. I do the research, I write the paper, I bring the materials that you need to put maybe your legal opinion together. I do a lot for the firm as well. So I don't think there is, I think this narrative about, oh, the fact that you're learning under us means we can't pay you or we don't pay you should be changed, because it's a give and take situation. As much as I'm learning and building my experience for work, I'm also giving something back to your firm. I'm also giving something back to your company. So I think not just for law firms, even some companies that don't pay interns that tell you, even if you're not paying the person exactly a huge amount, maybe, how do they call it, stipend or stipend or whatever?
I think that that's maybe how it is tagged, the stipend.
Exactly. So let them something that you know you are taking home, not 5,000 anyways, because I think you're something that at the end of the day, they say, come and take envelope, and then you open envelope and you see 5,000 there, I'll cost you. So basically.
Anyway, I feel like exposure doesn't pay the bills. I know there's a song, on TikTok that says exposure doesn't pay the bills. So yeah, I think that's it. That's the overall message. I mean, people have to be compensated for their work.
Sure.
Like people have to be compensated, not just as your not just as an expression of the employer's largesse, but like the employer has to understand that the intern, the law school student, whoever, is providing a service, an invaluable service that should be compensated in a way that reflects the value that is provided. Not just because I'm kind, but you're coming, like, because that kind of, because I'm kind is what, like, now make them put money in an envelope and say, come and take at the end of the day, and then they feel like but it's like, do you know how much I spent even coming here on a daily basis? Again, people should not work for you, and then it's a loss in terms of like their net expense and profit calculation. Like people should not expend their own resources adding value to you as a business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, so so I'll be resuming law school this month, and I know that there's
where are you going to law school?
End of the month, but I don't know
where. What location?
Exactly. So there's a part of your book that actually speaks about someone who, you know, fails the bar and all. So I want your advice, and to everyone listening here who's actually preparing for the bar, preparing to go to law school, what do you think we can do? And if for some reason someone actually does fail the bar, what advice can you give for such a person?
Oh wow. I've never had to like contemplate that this question would be asked to me. Advice to people going into law school as they prepare for the bar. First of all, don't listen to or don't believe, don't buy into the negative hysteria that the bar exam is out to defeat you. One of the things that I sort of the mindset that I took into the bar, and like shortly after I passed, like in the couple of years after that, one of the things I used to say to people who were writing the bar at the time was, you have everything, like nobody is more qualified than you to pass the bar exam. If you have successfully gone through 5 years of legal education, and in that 5-year period, you wrote your exams yourself, and a university certified you as fit and proper to go to law school, be further educated, you have everything it takes to pass the bar exam. Yes, there's a hysteria of, oh, the bar exam is like much different than what you wrote in university, blah, blah, blah. I think it's the same set of basic skills, your capacity to understand principles and recall the specific cases and statutes that inform these principles. Like that's the bottom line. It's a lot more cramming, as it were, than exposition as in university. But trust me, you have all the tools needed to defeat the system. Like I truly, truly believe that. I think that people sort of cuddle under the fear of failure, than like an actual lack of inability to pass. So I think what really like gets people is that they are too afraid to even like give it their all, because like there's this myth surrounding the bar part 2 exam. Guys, chill. I promise you, without even knowing you, I can tell you that if you've gone through the 5 years of legal education, or the 3 years of legal education if you're a foreign, if you are coming in as a foreign student, you have all it takes to pass the bar exam.
Wow, thank you. That's really comforting to hear, to be honest, Olaola. So our audience, please don't be afraid if you're preparing to resume law school. Please just know that you have all of the tools that you need, like Olaola has said. So over to you.
Yes. I think I'll just add to what Olaola said about passing the bar. Like she said, you have all the tools. Because experiencing loss myself, they call us the COVID set.
Because you were part of the COVID set.
Yes.
The COVID How was set, that?
It was really difficult because we basically had school online and we had to basically teach ourselves through it. So it was very difficult.
We had the ones that had to, that had to write a letter, like insisting that they set a date. Was that your set for your exam?
No. It wasn't my set. But yes, they kept on pushing us back and forth before we finally resumed again. And then it was like, upon resumption, exams was in less than a month. So it was a whole rush. And for people who had sat at home for about 8 months after resuming, so we resumed law school February 2020. And then by March 2020, we're back home. So we stayed at home again. It was more than 8 months, actually, almost a year, because we went back to law school February 2021. And by March, we were writing our exam. So if you are not taking your time to be consistent with reading, following the online classes and all that, because it could get tiring. You're reading and reading and reading, and you're hoping, okay, this lockdown will end, I'm going back to school. But that's for my set, and it was different. But now I feel it's just go with the mindset of, okay, I'm going to pass this thing, like Olaola said. Prepare yourself, give yourself a strategy. Don't let the fear. Yes, the bar exam, there are a lot of stories around it, and you know how the marking system can be added, but don't focus on all of that. Just focus on doing your thing and putting your best to it. Once you do that, you come out, you get your good grades, and you move from there. So I think, speaking about good grades, I think this will lead me to something else that I've always had in mind. So there is this, should I call it a situation or tradition or custom that goes on in our law space or our legal space. So you finish from the Nigerian, and I also think that there's something wrong with the Nigerian, with the grading system. I feel we should not have this first class, second class upper, second class lower pass. Let it just be you pass the bar or you failed the bar. So you have a degree from university, you graduated with the first class, second class, upper, or that's fine. Class of degree is there. Then you pass or you fail the bar. Because it's really causing issues. I have friends who, luckily, I would say fortunately, let me not use luckily, I worked out for it. So fortunately, and thanks to God, I graduated with a 2-1 from the Nigerian Law School. Yeah, but I'm not so happy about how there's a bias for, okay, you must have graduated with a first class or with a 2-1 before you get an actual job at a law firm. I have friends who did so well in uni, like graduated with 2-1 in uni, or even a first class from uni. You're getting a 2-2 from the Nigerian law school. And then it becomes a thing. Oh, why do you have a 2-2? We are only taking first classes and second class upper people and all that candidates. I even had people who had passed stages of law firm interviews before the law school result came out. So I've gone through all the stage, and then you get a conditional offer that, okay, it's upon your law school result. And then you graduate from the law school, you see your result that you got your 2-2. And all of a sudden, the same law firm that you were so good enough to pass all their stages are telling you are not good enough to be an associate just because of your grade. I know grades mean a lot, but we also need to understand that there are factors to how grades come about. The fact that it could be just one course, and we know exactly, we know how the law school marking system is. It could be just one course a person got lesser than the others, and that's the whole thing. So I think what I'm just trying to point out, not a question, I'm just trying to make the commentary on the fact that I think something needs to be done about that as well. Maybe the body of ventures, Council of Legal Education, needs to think back about this. Could we just have a pass or fail system of marking, so we know everybody that passed, we're all on the same level. There is no, I finished from law school with the first, let's do that for the university. Let's all know that, I passed the bar or I failed the bar. So, moving on.
I just wanted to add, can I add to that, just to say that it's also interesting because the skills that are needed to pass in both university and law school are entirely different from the skills that you need to excel in practice. So if somebody has excelled in a test that your law firm set, presumably a test that is founded on how like true law practice works, I can't understand why you would disqualify that person based off of their grade in law school, when we all know that whatever it is we're learning in law school and in university has to do with how practice like, truly works.
Very true. Very, very true. So let's go to the creative side of this conversation. So let's focus. We'll be focusing on you as a lawyer. Let's focus on you as a writer, and let's talk about how being a writer and being a lawyer, how it like just flows together. So I've noticed, and I'm sure Jerome was have noticed as well, and you too, that there are many lawyers that venture into other professions. Most of the time, they could be creative professions, writers, musicians. We have files. We have dancers. Actors like. Exactly, we have answers, just a whole lot of them. And we've had quite a number on the Writer Source podcast as well. A number of writers who are actually lawyers. The last one you said you listened to Achaligo's episode. And Achaligo is also a lawyer, just like yourself. So I just want to know, do you have any idea what this thing is for lawyers and being attracted to the arts? And specifically to you, what attracted you to writing?
First of all, I think that the law lends itself very easily to creative enterprise, especially writing. I think that more so than any other of the big four that our parents reversed, more than medicine, more than engineering, more than accounting, more than I want to be like. I think like law lends itself to you sort of segueing into a profession in the creative industry. Writing, because like in law, you're doing a lot of reading, you're doing a lot of writing, you're doing a lot of persuasive writing. And like, isn't that what a lot of creative writing is? Essentially trying to convince your reader to see the world in the way that you see it. At least how I interpret what creative writing does. It's like you're painting a picture and you're convincing your reader to believe that picture is true. As with law, you are writing an argument and convincing your judge or jury to believe that that argument is the truth. I think Chinaza, of course, I was really excited, like medicine and arts. I was like, aha! this is remarkable. I think Chinaza, I also know like Dami Ajayi, I think he's who is concurrently runs a career in writing as well. But also you mentioned not just writing, it's also like the dramatics.
Yeah.
I think a lot of lawyers are closeted creative artists. So like people who wanted to like study arts in school, but their Nigerian parents were like, no, you must do law. And so they're like, fine, I guess I'll do the law. Here's your certificate. Let me go and do what I want to do now. For me, especially, I know that I've always known I wanted to be a lawyer. But it's also that I think I realized that I would have done badly in any other of the, again, big fours, because I was just horrible at math. let me go and do this law, which is a bit of a miscalculation, because then I ended up in law and then I was like, corporate law. Antitrust. here is my nemesis, mathematics. What are we going to do here now?
You're recalculating.
I know, right? But I mean, it's like when you read cases and then you're like seeing all this drama just playing out in terms of the facts of the case, some of the way that you sustain yourself in having to like study through stacks and stacks of legal texts and case law is that you, in your mind, begin to imagine how they really played out in real life. And then, like, by the time you get on the path of imagining, you are right on the path of either dramatizing or writing the drama of it or creating a song inspired by the drama of it. I don't know. I just think law lends itself easily to the creative profession very easily.
Yeah. Thank you, Lalo. And I think we should do it with labels. because labels, you know, they kind of box you and limit you. And I feel you can be as many things as you want to be. You can be a lawyer and a writer and maybe a volunteer. You can do as many things as you want to do. So yeah. I feel like people say, oh, you're a lawyer, so why are you writing? Mm-hmm. What brought you to the arts should not startle anybody, should not be surprising to anybody. You can be whoever you want to be, do whatever you want to do, because you have the right to. So I just want to chip this in. So I know that you're starting a podcast. So I just want our audience to know that.
I'm really excited about it.
We're excited for you too as well. I know, okay, so you'll be starting a podcast about law and literature. So can you just, I know the energy is high, just let us know what your podcast is going to be about. You know, give us some
We propose, where the podcast takes us, we don't know, but we propose to attempt to do like a law and literature thing. So it's me and I have a co-host, Christopher Andy.
Okay.
A lawyer and a writer, but so he does, well, he studied law and he qualified as an attorney and he's called the Nigerian Bar, but I think he's more, he has submitted himself more to the path of the creative enterprise. So he's a writer and he's a graphic artist and he does like really great work. But especially like this is why I think he's going to be remarkable on the podcast. I think he is he missed his calling as a stand-up comedian. So someone I went to school together, to Unilag together. And like he's always been like the funny man in class. Like he's always been not just funny, but also like insightful in the way that he like experiences the world and in the way that he observes what's going on. And I think like that's a skill that will be really useful on the podcast, because what I bring to the podcast is the boring aspect of attempting to sort of take the fun part of law, with the fun part of writing, which is literature. And then I'm like, oh yes, let's see how we can analyze like legal institutions and like legal like jurisprudence and things through like literature. And I think that the energy that he will bring is finding insightful ways to comment on how literature speaks to law. So when you say what is the podcast about, essentially it's attempting to use literature to comment on law and society. So law as it is applied in our social context, applied by the judges, applied by police, applied by just the average man, like what the average man thinks about the law and how that is reflected in literary text. The text that we propose to use for the first season is our very, what text would you, like, comes to your mind when I say it's a classic work of literature? It is probably one of the first books that you read as literature. Mm. What comes to you? Let me have you guys be my test audience.
If anything from Chinua Achebe.
Which Chinua Achebe book? I think the book selection is right. So we're using Things Fall Apart, which I hope is like a book that a large cross section of people can connect to analyze the different aspects of how law works in our society today. And we're going to be like relying heavily on case law, so like how the judges have interpreted to policing institutions. I mean, I've been doing some research for the podcast already, and I think it's going to be a blast. Again, I am excited because like my research here as well is on law and literature. So I think what I'm really doing is having Chris and his wit and humor sustain me for my research and then pretending.
Oh my god! Oh my god! This sounds really interesting.
Like very, very interesting. I can't wait for it. We cannot wait.
I hope you can fulfill. I mean, Chris, if the podcast falls flat, it's not on Christopher. Christopher is going to be the same game.
Okay, so I think we'll be rounding up right about now. But I must say that you really did a good work with YMBA. It's a standard debut, very interesting, and I think it's a book I would recommend to anyone to pick up. So I'm saying it again to you listeners, do get yourself a copy of the book and just experience the whole drama that goes down, because there's so much to laugh about, there's so much to think about, there's so much to say, wait, this actually really happens. But I must also say that I think there is progress happening in the bar, or like the future, the young lawyers are taking the future. I mean, you, Olaoluwa, you also talked about this in your article, The Brave New Bar, which, where you commented about Mr. Olumide Akpata winning the NBA elections in 2020. And you said something about him being the product of our advocacy, the anointed flag bearer for the will of young lawyers, and nothing but love and commitment of young lawyers could have won him this victory. So I think that something is happening. New lawyers are standing up, young lawyers are standing up, and we're trying to like make progress for ourselves in this industry, or in this field, in this profession. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Ufoma.
You're welcome.
It was wonderful having you on our podcast.
Thank you, Joelle. Thank you so much. This was such a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed myself.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. So, guys at home, do listen to Olaoluwa's podcast when it drops. We're going to let you know. And also, get yourself...
Please do.
Please do. And get yourself ready for season 2 of the Fit and Proper podcast. I'm sure you enjoyed Joelle today. So, she's going to be dishing you guys with, like, back-to-back with her different guests that she's going to be having on the podcast. So you don't want to miss it, though. Joelle has told you. So join Joelle and share with your friends and everyone. You heard it here first. Also, don't forget to get yourself a copy of the YMBA. Saying it one last time so that you don't forget, and enjoy the beautiful story. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just tell you people, it's not just about lawyers. If you want a good story, go and get the book and read. So once more, thank you again, Olaoluwa. Thank you, Joelle, for joining me this evening. So, and I'm really glad we had this specific episode. It's been a good one. So, guys,
thank you, ladies. I really enjoyed myself.
You're welcome. Thank you. So, bye, guys.
Bye,
and see you episode of our podcast. Enjoy your day, evening, afternoon, morning, wherever you are. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Fit and Proper podcast, brought to you by Digilaw Productions. You can find the Fit and Proper podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe and leave us a good rating. Also, favorite us on Anchor and subscribe on Google Podcasts or Spotify. Until we meet again, stay fit and proper.